And our special guest tonight, Mr. Science, Richard Hoagland. And we'll be back with Richard in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Richard Hoagland with us as well. Richard, why don't you give us an update on where we left off here talking about YU-55 and what the Russians are up to?
Well, if you looked at those radar images coming from Goldstone a couple days before the flyby, if you look carefully, there's geometry, there's structure on that object. And they were not the best radar images. The best ones we have not seen. They have not shown them to us. They don't intend to show them to us. And no one seems to really be interested in having them show them to us, which I find really amazing, because there's whole websites devoted to unmanned spaceflight and, you know, NASA activities and all that. And those people seem to be dead from the neck up. Like, they don't realize that there was a 48-hour embargo. They've got radar of it coming in. Then there's nothing. They got radar of it going away. But the good stuff, they're not getting to see, and they're not mad. They're not angry. They're not up in arms. They're not saying, where is it? They accept the cover stories. They're dead from the neck up. However, the day after the flyby of this so-called asteroid, a story appeared in the BBC. Remember this one?
Go ahead.
Where the NASA scientist in charge of the Goldstone radar efforts talked about strange structures on the surface of YU-55?
Yes, and that is exactly how they labeled it.
He didn't call them formations, like geological formations, or strata, or craters, or features. He said structures. Leak, big leak.
And then what happened to the guy?
Well, everything went silent. Nobody's talking, nobody's putting out data, nobody's publishing. However, the same night, within an hour of this thing coming by, the Russians launched their probe. I wondered myself, why were they launching that same night? Again, you know, you got a nice little note from Jerry Pournelle, who said hi to me in the note, and he pointed out that there should be overlapping windows for going to Mars because they're at a different latitude than the Cape, and they have a different ISP for their fuel compared to the fuels that we use, et cetera, et cetera. But it should be an overlapping window, not a window for the Russians that begins on the 8th of November and ends on the 21st or 24th, and then an American window that begins on the 25th, because that's when they were originally going to launch Curiosity, and they delayed one day because of a battery problem, and then ends on December 18th.
And don't you...
2 weeks with two separate windows is just nonsense, again, because nobody asked any questions.
And isn't it curious, though, Richard, that everyone seems to be going there, seems to be going there at the same time?
Well, yeah. You know, well, the reason for Mars is you can only go there within that two-week window. In fact, it's curious that the head of the Atlas program liaison for NASA, NASA over the weekend after the successful launch or during the successful launch of Curiosity, did what they call a tweet-up at the Cape. And all weekend, they ran the same tapes over and over and over again. So I got to memorize every single sentence of every single NASA official who came to the tent at the Cape to talk to all the folks gathered for the tweet-ups. And so you remember these very specific little things. Well, this one guy who was in charge of NASA's liaison with the Atlas program at, I guess it's General Dynamics, which is building the Atlas V, which is the basic launch vehicle for Curiosity. It's an Atlas Centaur launch, the same kind of launch vehicle, by the way, that the X-37B uses. This and the New Horizons spacecraft used to get to Pluto in a very brief period of time. It'll be there in like 2015. The same spacecraft combination, booster combination, used by the La Crosse mission to send the La Crosse spacecraft to the moon.
It's
a very big rocket. It can do very heavy or fast things. The X-37B is launched into low Earth orbit for reconnaissance missions on an Atlas Centaur. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
Isn't that overkill?
That's a lot of firepower.
As I said to one of my intel guys, I said, wait a minute. That means that sucker can go to the moon, Alice. So my scenario, which they've kind of not said no. You know, you have to understand how these people talk? I said, you could send that X-37B around the moon, gather reconnaissance on the moon bases, which are there, which we now know scientifically are there, and we've discussed that data on this show, George. Remember the Indian missions mm-hmm. found an atmosphere on the moon 40 times denser
than they thought.
Than it should have been after Apollo? Somebody's living there, and spacesuits and airlocks leak. So the somebody we're eavesdropping on using the X-37B, that's my scenario. And I said, with that kind of firepower, you could easily send it to rendezvous with YU-55 as it was coming through the system. You had months of a head, years of a heads up. They'd known this thing was coming.
Oh, sure.
And so you send it out, you bring it back, it then goes back into Earth orbit, and then it re-enters, but it's going to re-enter early because it's going to bring home the bacon that you don't transmit because you don't want the bad guys running around out there to know where this little thing is. Remember, unless you transmit, a little tiny aircraft-type thingy in the dark is invisible even to very sophisticated technology. Space, yes, is that big and cavernous and huge. So, in the scenario, the Russians know we're doing all this, right? And the deal is, because this is not really a space race 2. This is a covert cooperation with the illusion of a competition. They say, well, wait a minute. We've got this really nifty craft that's going to go to a, quote, asteroid called Phobos in Mars orbit. What if we diverted to YU-55 after the flyby, and then we bring home samples? Remember, that's what they're going to be able to do?
Right.
If they land on this little sucker, which has no gravity, or they land on Phobos, which is little and has no gravity, it's the same thing. Space is space is space. It doesn't care.
And this is closer, isn't it?
It's much closer, and the delta Vs, if you do all the calculations, even on an envelope, it works out that they can actually bring home something really cool besides loitering with it and getting imagery of every crevice, every building, every dome, every amazing structure that was reported by the BBC via the JPL guy, head of the radar project, a few weeks ago.
I mean, when I saw that story that, you know, there were structures, he said, I mean, that was the weirdest
thing. Your alarm bells went off.
Yeah, it's just a weird statement.
You sat in that chair how many years, George?
Yeah, a long time.
You develop a radar. That was a deliberate leak. Now, why would they leak? Why would they be leaking something? Because following my friend Gene Roddenberry's rule, which is, Dick, when he saw the Sidonia photographs I took down to him the first time before he died, he said, Dick, if this was real, it would be on television. My scenario has been that even the insiders who get the briefings, it's so amazing, it's so fantastic, it's so out of the ordinary with everyday life, and Paris Hilton and Lady Gaga and, you know, the guys running for the survival, you know, who's going to survive the island in the Republican nomination process, that they have to see it in media before they really get that it's real. I mean, I ran into this decades ago when I first started talking about Mars and what's in Sidonia. Some smart-ass, radio guy, don't pick on radio guys, in, I think, Utah said, but Hoagland, if this was real, it'd be all over NBC. Well, that's people's perspective. They don't believe it unless it's in big media, big television.
No, you're right. You're
on
right.
Coast, and, on and as, the New York Times.
And as you know now, most of the major media picks up on our stories 2 weeks later.
Or a decade later. We are so far ahead sometimes.
Well, I'm curious about how you came up with this 65 million year possible war and that this is a spacecraft. How did you come up with that? In as much as I want to talk about Michael Cremo for a second.
Okay.
Who believes that our society, our planet with humans is much older, that humans may be 100 million years old.
Yeah, I think.
Is it possible that this craft might have been one of ours?
Yes. Remember, the model here is that Farrell and I and others have talked about, and you can talk to Joseph, you should have him on again, to kind of kick this idea around. We used to live, meaning we the human species, our dim great 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 ancestor, genetically related, not identical, but related to us genetically, used to live in this solar system in something we would call a Type 2 civilization.
That's right.
That term comes not from Mishyukaku, who kind of borrowed the term, but from a Russian named Kardashev, who was the grad student of the guy who first proposed, the guy named Shlovsky, back in the 50s, that Phobos and Deimos were artificial satellites of Mars. So Kardashev in the 60s, not to be outdone by his professor, he's thinking about advanced civilizations and ETs, and, you know, he realizes that they have to go probably through an evolutionary process. And so using energy control as his criteria, mm-hmm. the amount of total energy controlled by a civilization, he coined the Type 1, Type 2, Type 3. Type 1 is a civilization that controls the energy of its planet. A Type 2 is the civilization that controls the energy of its star, the sun. And a Type 3 would be that which could control the energy of its galaxy, 400 billion suns.
Okay.
We're supposed to be on that scale, according to Sagan, who came into this picture because he and Shlovsky wrote a book, a brilliant book called Intelligent Life in the Universe, back in 1966, which is back when I first met Carl. Carl thinks that we're about a 0.7. We're not even a type 1.
No, we're not even a 1 yet.
Yeah. And we will not become a 1 until we actually get rid of fossil fuels and all that crap and go to true hyperdimensional physics. And then you rapidly go from type 1 to type 2 to type 3 because it's unlimited energy. It's not coming from this dimension.
Well, if it's fossil fuels, I still think it's abiotic.
Well, that's a whole other conversation, and you're right, but that's a whole other evening. So we're a type 0.7. The structures that we see on three different sets of data, NASA, ESA, and Russian, all argue that there are inhabited structures, ancient ruins, meteor bash, you know, remains all over the damn solar system, from Mercury all the way out to Neptune. I've got data now. And it's not just one source. It's not just NASA data. It's European data, which is primarily of the moon and or Mars. It's Russian data, which is of Mars and of the moon. And then it's some amazing data from NASA, including the Cassini mission, which shows stunning asteroid size actual spaceships, including one that they flew by with a redirected mission that went and smashed into the Temple 1 comet a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
The mothership, after they released the probe that smashed into the comet that stood up and took the pictures, was renamed Epoxy, which is a weird acronym. I'm not even going to bore people with what it means. And then a few years later, it was redirected to fly by a little comet called Hartley 2. And I have got the most astonishing leaked image from inside showing unequivocally that Hartley 2 is an ancient abandoned spaceship that's roughly a mile and a quarter long.
Why did they abandon all these craft?
Because they were destroyed in the war. You know, if you have a big spacecraft, you know, which is a mile or so in diameter, maybe 3 or 4 miles, which in space is nothing. Because remember, they're not using rockets. They're using real anti-gravity, hyperdimensional torsion field propulsion.
Well, I guess they're not going to tow it home, right?
But where's the home? The whole system was destroyed. There was this humongous cosmic war which literally blew up a planet. And when you blow up a planet, it ruins the neighborhood for millions of years.
Well, I guess it sure does, especially if it was your planet.
Well, certainly if it's your planet, but it ruins everybody else's too. And it's very easy to understand why without getting into great details. If you have enough energy and you blow a planet to smithereens, to kingdom come, and reduce the material of that planet to little tiny particles like sand particles, you have sandblasting occurring at orbital speeds on every exposed planetary surface in the system for millions of years thereafter.
That's true.
Until all the debris finally collides with something and either falls into the sun through pointing Robertson effects or is blown away into interstellar space. So you wind up ruining the solar system for everybody, and the civilization falls back to the one place which is still kind of survivable, which is the one planet with air, the Earth, and it devolves to a level of primitive society that is unrecognizable as human or intelligent, and then it has to climb back up the evolutionary ladder. That's what happened 65 million years ago in our overall reconstruction. And what we see out there now, which NASA has been actually looking at these remains, and I won't use the time tonight, but I'll use another show to describe how we have figured out how they know the junk, the rocks, from the spaceships. There's a way to tell the difference, even before you get there.
Would you say then that the chunk of rock, the 6-mile chunk of rock that wiped out the dinosaurs 60-plus million years ago, was from one of these planets that got blown up?
The planet that got blown up, go to the head of the class, George. That's exactly what happened. Except it wasn't a random chunk. It was a directed murder. It was assassination of the Earth. It was directed to hit at the most delicate, fragile point on the Earth, which winds up creating tremendous tremors inside the planet to kill it at 19.5 degrees.
It worked perfectly, didn't it?
Almost, because it took millions of years for life to recover to where there was almost anything. So where do the refugees go? Because remember, Type 2 civilization has interstellar travel. Some went somewhere else. I believe they went to Sirius, and they have now come back. That's the other guys who are out there tonight watching, observing, and maybe, just maybe, exercising influence on the geopolitics of the current mess we're in here on this planet. And what is the one nation which is symbolically called after that planetary system 8.7 light years away?
What?
Syria.
Interesting.
The last in the chain of the Middle Eastern dictatorships to fall, with two battle fleets arrayed offshore, Russian and American.
You do piece an incredible puzzle together, don't you?
I try to think the big picture.
Well, you're always out there. Richard, we're going to take a break pretty soon, but I want to talk with you about any updates on the face on Mars. It's been a while since
we've get to Mars.
Talked about that. We've got to get there. When are we going to go?
We're en route. The Curiosity mission, if I'm right, is going to be what you and I and Steve and a lot of other people have been waiting for. It's going to be disclosure. Not because they're nice guys that finally want to tell us the truth, but because somebody has arrived. In fact, one intel guy that I know pretty well said to me a couple, 3 years ago, some new folks have shown up, and we don't like them. Well, you know the old expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Yeah. Sir Charles Schulz, who does a lot of work like you,
he deals
with fossils. You both come at this with the same and sometimes different perspectives, but you're all coming in and you're looking at the same thing. He is so convinced that Mars was laden with all kinds of life forms. And, let's talk about that too, Richard, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, our special guest tonight is Richard C. Hoagland. We're talking space. We'll take some calls with Richard next hour on Coast to Coast AM. On our next program, by the way, we're going to be talking with an individual who saw demons, angels, and ghosts all around him. Make sure you're part of that Coast to Coast show. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So, Richard, Curiosity will get there sometime in 2012. What is the proposed mission?
Well, it's going to get there in August of next year. It goes directly in, does not go into orbit. This huge aerosol heat shield barrels through the atmosphere at 15, 20,000 miles per hour. It then discards all that, and in 6 minutes of sheer terror, because so many things have to happen absolutely right, nothing can go wrong.
Yeah, this is the nail-biting time, isn't it?
It's real, I think it was Ed Wyler who said, it's 6 minutes of pure hell for people who work for years on getting these missions ready. This thing goes from entry speed of 15, 20,000 miles an hour down to a few hundred miles an hour. And then in the last few thousand feet, it, for the first time, is going to be dropped vertically on a pair, on a set of steel cables from the rocket backpack jet thruster assemblage that's firing, I think, eight rockets in all four different directions, two in each direction. And like a sky crane, like those old Sikorsky sky cranes,
yeah,
this thing will be lowered with the rockets thrusting up above on steel cables down below. The whole rover assembly is unfolded, the wheels, the instruments, and everything, and it's going to be set down gently on a flat surface, and then the cables are cut pyrotechnically, and the carrier rocket ship above it flies away to crash several miles away when its fuel runs out.
Incredible. So no parachute on this one?
Nope. Well, the initial parachutes slow it down to the several hundred miles an hour. And then it pops out of the aeroshell, drops away the heat shield, and then this Rube Goldberg contraption of sky crane, cables, jets firing. I mean, the whole thing, look at the animations on, you know, go to NASA, NASA.gov, and pull up the YouTube animations.
Okay.
This is stunning. Now, the reason they've gone to this enormous length for a 2,000-pound, 1-ton small car, like a Mini Cooper-size rover.
And is this the first time we've used this kind of technology?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, it's been tested here on Earth, but you can never really test this stuff on Earth because you can't really get up to the speeds and the density of the atmosphere.
That's right.
Coming back, you know, this is the first time it will have been used in an operational mission. And the reason is the place where they're going. They're going to this place at about 5 degrees south longitude, latitude on Mars, and 137.3 degrees east longitude, called Gale Crater. Like, you know, Gale Storm, G-A-L-E.
G-A-L-E, right.
And what makes Gale Crater different, it's almost 100 miles across. It's very, 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 very ancient, really ancient. But in the middle of it sits this mountain that nobody can figure out how it got there. You read all the papers, and they're completely bamboozled and flummoxed, and they admit freely, we don't know how this thing formed. They got some crazy arm-waving ideas, but when you look at them closely, they don't really stack up, pun intended. I sent to Lex and Tom Bunnell, actually posted them because Lex is off tonight.
Yeah, Tim's
two
gone.
Images. Showing the color-coded isocontour elevation and depth map, that's the color one, and a black-and-white MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, close-up, showing the target area and what they're going to be looking at. And when you look at the color view, which is the isocontour elevation, it's obvious. I mean, anybody who's followed our work for any years will know instantly by looking at that picture why NASA picked, of all the gin joints in all the world, you know, the old, Casablanca thing, why they picked that gin joint to go to. Because plunked down in the middle on the top of this mass in this crater is a 30-mile on a side tetrahedral pyramid arcology.
So it's a good spot to go.
It's an ancient structure, George, built by the Type 2 civilization we were just discussing. And it's incredibly old. And in fact, it seems to come in two flavors or two levels. A newer portion built on top, that's the tetrahedron. And the understructure underneath, which is almost eroded away, which has another kind of geometry. I think it's five-sided, but I'm not sure. I have to do more measurements. What the rover's going to do, what Curiosity is going to do, it's going to land in the level, flat sediments of what they think may have been an ancient lake.
Wow.
Back when there was a lot of water on Mars, and sediments tend to be flat, like the Bonneville Dunes, except this is not salt flats, it's just desert flats. And this thing will come down vertically on the sky crane, cables and all that. Then it will take off under nuclear power, George. For the first time, we will have a nuclear-powered rover on Mars.
That's right.
Which, according to the tweet up I saw over the weekend from the DOD, Department of Energy head of the power production part of the Curiosity program has a lifetime of, ready, 14 years.
We don't have to worry about solar panels getting dusty.
Now, here's what's really cool. One of my guys from Australia on my Facebook page, by the way, if you want to join the conversation on what's going on this incredible mission and stuff I'm talking about tonight, go to Facebook. I have two pages. I have a friend's page, so you can't get in there until somebody, you know, kind of dies or falls away by attrition. But I have a fan page which has almost 30,000 people, and you can just like it and then join the conversation.
Right.
Richard C. Hoagland, it's no spaces, Richard C. Hoagland at Facebook, and you'll find me.
And you've got a link on Enterprise, don't you?
And we don't have a blog, another blog, but a board on Enterprise. Enterprise is for posting papers.
But no, but I mean, do you have a link to Facebook?
At the very top of the Enterprise Mission website,
good.
There's a
That's
link
easier.
Right to my fan page on Facebook. So
good.
People can go to enterprise.com, click on the link to Facebook at the top, takes you right to the conversation. The reason the conversation is important is all kinds of people who are on the deep inside are using Facebook to leak us further information.
That's right.
It's the most incredible thing. Remember, these two battle fleets assembling in the Eastern Mediterranean, every one of those Russians and Americans is on Facebook.
How long does it take you to go through your Facebook messages?
I can't. It scrolls down much too fast. I try to hit like one every fifth or tenth, or, you know, I try to get the high spots, the important stuff.
Yeah.
Because people post all kinds of clues.
You need an assistant just to go through your stuff.
I need many assistants.
Yeah.
For that, I need funding.
Yeah.
Hint, hint.
Yeah,
we have a PayPal button over on Enterprise.
That's right.
Anyway, so
you're the only science advisor who works for free, by the way.
Okay.
Just so you know.
But I'm going to get my own show.
You get a show.
I should probably get more than one because of the time. I've been waiting for the right thing to talk about.
Well, maybe we'll do a double or nothing bet.
Oh, yeah. He's going to be reelected in 2012.
Uh-huh. You want to do a double?
Really,
we'll talk about that.
George, do you really want to bet against me?
Oh,
haven't
what
you
do
learned
I,
by now?
Well, it's double or nothing. I like those odds. You know?
Of course you would. Because what was the other side of that? Well, look, we're getting ourselves distracted here.
Get back to curiosity, because this is indeed a very curious machine.
Well, of course, because of all the places they could have gone, all the gin joints.
And why would they call it curiosity?
Exactly. Well,
my gosh.
You remember the old joke, curiosity killed the cat, satisfaction brought him back?
Mm-hmm.
What's the eastern side of the face on Mars?
What is the eastern side?
The eastern side of the face on Mars is Cydonia.
Okay.
It's a kitty cat. It's a feline. I laid this out at the UN in 1992, proven by Mike Mill and his cameras, you know, when Mars Surveyor finally got into orbit in 1998. So I think, because I was told again by sources, that this is one of the most protected pieces of information, the feline nature of the face on Mars and what that implies about terrestrial connections, I believe they named Curiosity. They selected the gal who, you know, they what they did is they put this thing out for an open contest, right? School kids all over the world.
Yeah.
Then they selected the name they already wanted to call it.
That's right.
And this kid.
They look for the kid who named it.
They look for the kid. And she's actually very bright and she's very excited and it's going to change her life. But they already knew they wanted to call it Curiosity because it's a pun about the feline nature of the ancient civilization on Mars, the Type 2 civilization, the same feline civilization that Willie Ley came over from Nazi Germany in 1933, immigrated to the United States, became a major astronomical rocket expert back when there were no such animals, wrote for many magazines, had columns, ultimately wound up working with Walt Disney and with other major television and film producers, and wound up as writing the pilot show for a TV series in the 50s called Tom Corbett Space Cadet, where Americans go to the moon, find a glass tetrahedron, which sends them to Mars, to the ruins of an ancient civilization, which has cat-like beings on statues outside, which sends them to the asteroid belt, where they find the actual civilization with an ancient library and kitties floating in zero-G and holograms that tell them the entire hidden history of the human race.
He either had a vivid imagination or somebody tipped him off.
He had clues. He had texts. He came from Nazi Germany. What was it that Hitler and Goebbels were doing? They were sending teams all over the world to look for our hidden history.
Yes, they
you
did.
You really should have Joseph Farrell and me on some night to kind of kick around this whole idea of what did they know and when did they know it and what are they doing about it now that we all need to know.
That is remarkable. It really is, Richard.
So, the clues have been out there to be assembled properly. Why are we finally going to get an open source view of the hidden history? Because someone, I think, in our scenario, is forcing both sides, all sides, because it's more than two-sided, it's more like tetrahedral, three-sided, four-sided. They're forcing them to disclose now. And it's in 2012, the magic date of the Mayan calendar. Remember, apocalypse does not mean catastrophe and destruction, George. It means enlightenment. This is the enlightenment. This is what the Mayans were telling us was coming.
But you think, you really think that they're going to tell us?
No, they're being forced to tell us because someone has given them, what's that old line from The Godfather? An offer they can't refuse? Remember what happened in Norway back in 2009 when President Barack Obama was going to claim his Nobel Prize, which he had done nothing to deserve?
We got the spiral up there.
We got the huge Norway spiral, which if you go to Enterprise and read my series, my paper, four parts, on the Norway spiral, the physics and geopolitics of the Norway spiral, was obviously a tour de force demonstration of a magical technology that was being flaunted both in front of the U.S. that night, because the president was arriving to pick up his prize, and the same night, a big, huge tetrahedron hung over the Kremlin, an actual spacecraft of some enormous potential and power, hanging there over the center of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, where Soviet generals went on television and wrote columns saying, oh, the airspace of Moscow is secure and totally, you know, safe and nothing can penetrate. Well, obviously, they're whistling past the graveyard because this huge thing appeared and two guys running around Moscow in some, you know, Russian car photographed it on an HD camera, put it on Russian YouTube, which then went to the Western YouTube, and it went all over the world virally. The Russians wanted us to know, remember Roddenberry's rule, it's only real if it's going to be on television. They wanted the Americans to know what had appeared simultaneously with our president being greeted by a huge HD spiral over northern climes of Russia seen from Norway, home to the Nobel Prize now. This is a huge geopolitical chess game, and it's rapidly coming to mate and, you know, set.
This tetrahedron, this mountainous tetrahedron,
which you can see in the picture,
does it have great symmetry to it?
It has enormous. Just compare the model on the lower right-hand edge with the actual 3D colored isocontours. It's got one little lump, which obviously is due to erosion. It's sitting on this other geometry. Now, the cool part is Curiosity is lowered by the sky crane on August 6th. It then starts with its nuclear battery to wend its way toward this mountain, which rises 3 miles, even towering above some of the crater rim in this 100-mile-wide crater. Actually, it's 96 miles wide. Before it gets to the actual summit, which is going to take it years, it starts up through the edges of this other structure, and it's at those edges that the second photograph I have on your website, and I posted on Facebook tonight, was taken by MRO from orbit a couple of years ago. And it's a close-up of stunning geometry of 3D artificial ruins on the slopes, on the beginnings of the slopes of this massive construct in the middle of Gale Crater. And it's ancient. It's eroded. It obviously was preserved for millions of years by being covered by sediments, and then the sediments eroded away, and this stuff is left Of course, the geologists, and the way you hear the mission described, they're going to look at fluvial processes, they're going to look at phyllosilicates, they use all these geological terms to conceal what the real mission is, which is to look at this damn stuff and try to figure out what is there that they can analyze and send back as data that will tell them the scope and scale and age of this putative ancient Martian civilization. And one of my guys on Facebook tonight, a guy named Hugh Langer, came up with a brilliant idea. He said in Facebook, in those open public posts, he said, is it possible they chose nuclear energy for this mission as opposed to the solar cells of, you know, Spirit and Opportunity, the previous rovers? Because they're going to try to go inside where there's no sunlight.
Are those rovers, one of them's dead for sure. What about the other one?
Opportunity is still going.
That is amazing, too.
But yes, 5 years afterwards. Yeah. Well, if you project that they were supposed to last, what, 90 days?
Something like that. Yeah, that was successful if that had happened.
So they've lasted 5 years. This one has much better engineering because we know a lot more about the Mars surface problems than we did when they were designed. So if you can extrapolate that this one might last 5 years longer than the Martian year, which is two Earth years they're projecting, that would be what? 30 years? And the nuclear power sources that the SNAP program and the Department of Energy / DOD has designed going back to the Navy back in the 60s have typically lasted tens of times longer than their projected life. So if the projected life of the rover nuclear power supply is 14 years, and if we base it the real number on the Voyager mission, which was built for 5 years and is now approaching 50, 10 times, that means Curiosity could be tooling around this arcology or going other places, including Cydonia, because it could last 140 years.
Isn't that amazing?
This is the 21st century, and the only reason that any of this is relevant is because I think this is the mission which is going to be used to force disclosure of ancient people, ancient beings, an ancient civilization on the planet Mars, after which everything changes. I mean, nothing is left untouched. You talk about problems with the economy, kiss the problems with the economy of the world goodbye. You will see the greatest renaissance, the greatest economic boom, the greatest resurgence of art and science and industry and building and all the things we should be doing that we haven't been doing if this, in fact, happens next year in the year of 2012, in the year of consciousness revelation, the year of the true meaning of the apocalypse that we have ever lived through. And, George, you and I have front row seats to watch this happen.
We all do, Richard, indeed. Well, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more with you about things that you're doing, Richard C. Hoagland. And also, of course, we'll take phone calls with Richard C. when we come back. His website, enterprisemission.com. And as he said, look, every Coast member, go and be a friend of Richard C. Hoagland's on his Facebook. We'll be back.